Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wall Street's a gossipy place even in the best of times, but it's when the chips are down that the real rumors start. That mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are running out of money. That nobody wants to do business with Lehman Brothers, or that GM is considering bankruptcy. Forget the on-the-record denials all day today. If you say it often enough, the rumor affects the reality. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 10th of July today. Good to have you here. And truly, Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke couldn't have planned it better if they'd tried, because just as all those rumors were starting to pick up steam this morning, the Treasury Secretary and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States found themselves in front of the microphones testifying before the House Financial Services Committee. And they were saying basically the same thing. Unless you want another Bear Stearns, we need more rules to help control the markets, and we need them fast.
The broader reforms that I believe are necessary are obviously the purview of Congress, and we hope that you'll be addressing those issues in a timely way.
Secretary Paulson?
I agree very much with what the chairman has said.
And so, to take the day's rumors in sequence, the first was that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are in deep and serious trouble. Never mind that a Fannie Mae spokesman and its main government regulator came out this afternoon and said everything is fine. Wall Street deducted almost 14% from that company's stock price today, 22% from Freddie Mac's. And here's why. Because between them, they've got $5 trillion worth of outstanding mortgages, billions of dollars in losses. The Wall Street Journal reports the Treasury Department is so worried it's putting a contingency plan together, you know, just in case. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports there's really no other way out for the government, since Fannie and Freddie might be the very definition of too big to fail.
On Capitol Hill today, both Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson downplayed talk of a looming government bailout. Here's Paulson.
I don't think we should be speculating or talking about what-ifs with any particular institutions.
Fannie and Freddie are government-sponsored companies that buy mortgages from banks so they can keep on lending. Fannie and Freddie underwrite half the nation's mortgages, and as the housing crisis deepens, investors wonder if these giants have the capital to cover their loans. The Milken Institute's James Barth says there's added anxiety because Fannie and Freddie are supposed to be the mortgage mess solution, not the problem.
We know the Congress has been trying to shift a greater burden under Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to deal with the housing problems. The marketplace knows that and becomes wary of that sort of push.
To me, it is unimaginable that the government will not bail them out if they get into difficulty.
Peter Wallison follows Fannie and Freddie for the American Enterprise Institute. He says they've become so integral to the mortgage market, the government has no choice but to backstop them.
If now the federal government steps away from these obligations, it would reduce substantially the capital of all commercial banks and have a huge adverse impact on lending in the United States at a time when that's not what we need for our economy.
But the bill will go to taxpayers who'll be underwriting Fannie and Freddie's capital, and that would let them continue buying out bank mortgages. Mortgage industry analyst Tom LaMalfa says it's Fannie and Freddie's dominance of the mortgage market that caused the problem in the first place.
Because of their center stage position, if you will, they began to push more and more private sector lenders into niche markets. Ultimately, that led to the bubble that we've been experiencing.
LaMalfa says he and other analysts have been warning regulators for years that Fannie and Freddie had become the problem and not the solution for the mortgage industry. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Rumor number two was that some big customers have stopped doing business with Lehman Brothers. Again, forget the on-the-record denials from those customers who said their relationships with Lehman are just fine. Lehman shares tumbled 12% today. And finally, General Motors. Not for the first time, there's talk the country's biggest automaker might file for bankruptcy. Not true, CEO Rick Wagoner said today in Dallas. And as for that story we told you about on Monday, that GM is considering shutting down one or more of its eight brands.
Other than what we've talked about in studying the future of the Hummer brand, you know, I don't expect any big changes as far as our brand portfolio.
Another of the world's biggest companies is getting smaller, though. General Electric announced today it's thinking about spinning off its consumer and industrial division, appliances, lighting, those kinds of things. But Marketplace's Amy Scott reports GE still has plenty left.
GE switched on the first incandescent light bulb almost 130 years ago, but lately its outlook has dimmed. The stock is down about 25% so far this year. Christopher Bartlett is professor emeritus at Harvard Business School. He says CEO Jeff Immelt is under pressure.
And that means selling off parts of the organization that aren't growing as fast as his growth objectives.
Bartlett says areas like energy and medical products offer the most promise. GE's infrastructure business, it makes aircraft engines and wind turbines, drives roughly 40% of the company's sales. Back in May, GE announced plans to shed its appliance business. The company isn't ruling out a sale of the larger consumer division, but analyst Matt Collins with Edward Jones says it's a tough time to sell.
You look what's happening in the credit markets these days, it's very difficult for many buyers to get financing, so to sell a business this large is a bit more difficult than putting together a spinoff alone.
If the spinoff goes through, GE would simply create a separate company and issue new stock to shareholders. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Not a week goes by when we don't get another sign of just how turbulent the airline industry is. And now those airlines are literally begging for help from their customers. Major U.S. carriers have sent letters to their frequent flyers asking them to lobby Congress to crack down on speculation in the oil markets. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story.
Airlines have enlisted frequent flyers to ask Congress for help before, like right after 9/11, and it worked. This time, they want customers to know that high ticket prices hurt them, too.
I think the airlines are trying to present the perspective that, hey, we're as much of a victim as you are.
That's Seth Kaplan of Airline Weekly. He says what's odd this time is that some airlines have benefited from the very thing they're now against. Southwest locked in most of its fuel for this year at about a third of the current rate.
There's no more important factor in their profitability than some very well-timed hedges. That's speculation.
And it's debatable that removing speculators will be the silver bullet now. Rushir Kadakia is with Cambridge Energy Research Associates.
All it's going to do is actually just increase volatility, because now you have producers and consumers trying to find a pricing mechanism and price discovery in a market with fewer participants.
Congress already has more than a dozen bills on the table to cut back on speculation. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
That sound you heard in the oil trading pits today wasn't bubbling crude. It was saber-rattling over Iran and its missile tests. Oil spiked almost $6 today, over $141 a barrel. Despite that and all those ugly rumors, though, the major indices somehow ended the day higher than where they started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Walmart reported higher June sales today, but people who don't have a Walmart close to home are finding it might not be worth the gas to get those low, low prices. Well, who doesn't have a Walmart nearby, you say? Big parts of rural America don't, and after years of losing business to people willing to drive 20 miles to get to big box retail, local stores in some rural counties are seeing things pick up a bit. Jim Lottis runs a local chain called Rozier's Country Mart there in southern Missouri and Illinois, and we've reached him at a store in Chester, Illinois. And Mr. Lottis, let me ask you, what's a gallon of gas going for where you are?
Chester, let me ask my secretary here.
All
what's
right.
that going gas here? $4.09.
$4.09. That's not bad. I'm paying $4.57 on the way in. I mean, you know, relatively speaking.
That's Los Angeles, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Part of the reason we called you was to find out if you're seeing a benefit from people staying home and shopping local because it costs too much to drive to, say, the Walmart or the big malls.
And that's very true, especially like in St. John and Chester, there is no Walmart. So now instead of driving 20 miles north, they're just staying in town.
Would you say it's gas prices or just the fact that people don't have as much money these days because of the economy that's boosting your business?
Probably a little both, you know. But gas is a big part of it. That's the one you hear about the most by far, talking to customers and talking to people out on the street.
Were you able to compete with Walmart before?
Yeah, we've been competing with them since they probably came to our town in Perryville probably back in 1970. So a lot of the businesses have shut down, but we've just been able to hold on. And it's a family business. That started back in 1903. Cross our fingers, we always will be able to.
Now, here's the business strategy question for you, Mr. Lattis. You ready?
Sure.
How are you going to hang on to all these customers if gas prices ever settle down a little bit?
Well, actually, right now we're having a meeting in Chester talking about expansion to expand our produce and then maybe work in our meat department and make sure everybody you have what everybody wants for a small town. See what I'm saying? If you don't, they've got to go someplace else or other competition's got to come in. So you just have to be on top of it.
So if you're thinking about expansion, business must be pretty good.
Business is pretty good. We have grocery stores in Perryville, Missouri, and St. John and Chester, and we got a little department store in Perryville. Last week with 4th of July, and our hardware store was up, compared to last year, up about 20%. So what it means is that people are staying home, which benefits businesses in a small town.
We reached Jim Lattis in Chester, Illinois. He manages a Rozier's grocery store there and in another couple of places up and down the Mississippi River. Mr. Lattis, thanks a lot for your time.
Okay, thank you.
With less than a month to go until the Olympics, China is continuing its crackdown on perceived threats to the Games. In Xinjiang province today, out in the northwest part of the country, police shot and killed five members of what Beijing said was a Muslim extremist group. Commentator Ilya Shapiro says the Olympics are best used to promote cohesiveness, not politics.
World leaders are wringing their hands over this summer's Games in Beijing. But politicians' discomfort that the Games somehow legitimize human rights abuses reflects romanticized history. Since the end of the Cold War, the Olympics have thrown off the corrosive chains of ideological battle to revert to their original values. Among these values, the dominance of the personal over the national and the economic over the political. The standard view of the Greek Olympics was a festival uniting amateur sportsmen in the name of peace. It was invented by aristocrats like modern Games founder Pierre de Coubertin. Hitler, who staged the 1936 Games, had a similar romantic vision. The ancient reality could not have been further from these misconceptions. Athletes competed for filthy lucre, and armies routinely violated the Olympic truce. The modern Games broke with their predecessors. They allowed politics to overshadow sports. The communist bloc used the Games as an ideological showcase. While the Western world lay mired in stagflation, the Olympics lost their ancient bearings. Today's proliferation of commercialism is a positive step. The Olympics have returned to their fitting role as a forum for athletes seeking fame and riches, and showing the rest of us a good time. Tradition meet meritocracy, Coubertin meet Milton Friedman. The Games have reverted to their entertainment, ritual, and financial essence. So when the torch came to San Francisco, Arnold Schwarzenegger defended the right to censure China. But he opposed a boycott because sports, he said, should not be used to do diplomacy. History shows that the governator, a former Mr. Olympia, is right. Spotlight the horrific Chinese actions, but don't use sports for political purposes. Boycotts are a Cold War relic and a departure from the economics-focused origins of the Olympics.
Ilya Shapiro is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute. You can send us your thoughts online is best. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Coming up, making money fishing for ice.
Yeah, I really look forward to it now. I mean, after we made our first trip and saw that it was going to work. Yeah, I look forward to it, and no problem at all making a week's pay at it.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ticked up 0.7% today, 81 points to close at 11,229. The NASDAQ added 1%, 22 points, ended at 2257. The S&P 500 gained 0.7%, 8 points, finished at 1253, the S&P did. Traders saw the chemistry and Dow Chemicals buyout of Rohm and Haas. Rohm's shares rocketed more than 60, that is 60% on news of the merger. As I told you about earlier, it's lights out for GE's consumer unit, including the light bulb business started by Thomas Alva Edison himself. Shares lit up more than 1.5% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.8% on the nose. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for June. The Commerce Department reports on the trade balance for May. And can't find some members of your family? Have friends disappeared recently? They may be waiting in line to purchase the iPhone. They should call you sometime tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. One of the great things about the internet, maybe the great thing really, is that once you've got a connection, you can get online almost anywhere. And just as the web knows no boundaries, neither apparently do consumers. New research from Comscore shows many U.S. websites get more than half their traffic from users who are somewhere other than the United States. Now all those sites have to do is figure out how to cash in, as Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
People from Russia, China, and India now make up a big chunk of visitors to websites like The Washington Post, Condé Nast, and Facebook. But many overseas surfers end up hearing ads like this.
Used to be, portable DVD players were no match for peanut butter fingers and black cherry soda.
That's because many sites don't carry ads aimed at international visitors. Brian Cooley is the editor-at-large of CNET.com.
Google is putting international visitors in front of your site, and that has made it incumbent on U.S. websites to get international or leave a lot of money on the table.
But that can be complicated. Cooley says to cash in, it's imperative for companies to invest in understanding foreign markets.
And that's going to become, I think, a major area of upside for websites that can put the resources together to take advantage of that.
The payoff could be especially good news for American magazines and newspapers, which have seen ad revenue and circulation plummet. A Russian reading a blog could easily get linked to an article in the Detroit Free Press.
The majority of them come through side doors, and that can be a blog link, it can be a Google search or some other kinds of search.
Rick Edmonds is a media business analyst at the Poynter Institute. He says despite growing traffic, traditional media companies only spend about 10% of their ad budgets online, and a tiny fraction of that internationally. But that's starting to change.
There are plenty of new things that have potential. I think it's just going to be a time of experimentation.
U.S. companies are expected to spend nearly $20 billion advertising online this year. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
The global economy isn't all about huge conglomerates and multinational corporations. At its core, it's about a single person doing a job, trying to get by. Today on our series, Working, we meet a man who's facing a challenge familiar to anybody who lives a long way from the economic action. What do you do when your livelihood disappears? Wyman Richards is a fisherman way up in the northern tip of Newfoundland, where it's getting harder and harder to find fish. As a result, tens of thousands of Newfoundlanders have left the island. But Richards says he's not going anywhere, as Janet Graham explains.
About 70 people live in St. Carol's, and Wyman Richards is related to all but three of them. St. Carol's is so far north that it sticks out into the icy Labrador Current, kind of like a giant finger testing the temperature. This is where Wyman learned to fish with his father and his brother Dale when he left school after grade 7.
That's my boat right there. This little wharf that she's tied to in that old shed, that's mine and Dale's there. Everything's getting pretty run down here because this was a catfishing community.
Until the early 90s, when government mismanagement and offshore dragger fleets wiped the stock out, Wyman and Dale fished northern cod for a living.
When that closed down, we had a 2 or 3 years like doing nothing, no work around, and doing very little fishing in other things, in other species.
Other species like shrimp, crab, lumpfish, and seal, Wyman will give anything a try. And so this summer, an experimental species.
Icebergs.
Icebergs.
Yeah.
Every summer, massive chunks of ice are breaking away from the Greenland glaciers and floating slowly south, right past where Wyman lives. But just the sight of an iceberg will trigger a cursing fit among most fishermen. These jagged mountains of ice can rip the hull of a boat open in seconds. Think Titanic. So Wyman might be one of the first fishermen to navigate towards the bergs. It all started one day last spring in St. Anthony. It's a bigger fishing town just a few miles down the road. They docked their 38-footer, the Cape Richard, here. And so they got to know Marshall Dean. And Marshall dreams big.
Newfoundlanders have always been intrigued by icebergs and have always taken the bergy bits, we call them, from the ocean, I guess, over the years, and used them for ice cubes and drinking water at times, this kind of thing. So myself and a friend of mine, who is from the area as well, lives in Houston, Texas, decided that we'd do something commercially with the product.
80 degrees north, iceberg water tapped from icebergs born at the top of the world in the Arctic polar ice caps that date back 12,000 years, untouched by pollutants and toxins.
Yep, $1.60 a bottle in Texas. Of course, bottling a berg can take some doing. We're 4 miles from St. Anthony with Wyman and his brother Dale and 15-year-old nephew Damien. The water's choppy today. It's not a great day for the job.
How far away would you say we are from that big iceberg there?
Well, we're probably about 2 miles there right now. I'd say about a mile and a half.
10 minutes later, and we're close enough to see the turquoise glow beneath the waves. The iceberg, a great white mountain of razor peaks with ridges of snow.
Yeah, now that one there, he had a massive breakup sometime last night. They tend to break up like in the evenings after it's a really warm day. Then when it starts to cool off in the evening, they tend to break up.
Wyman has to get close enough that he can scoop up the smaller bergy bits without getting too close. Because when the berg starts to break up, it can roll and crush a boat like this.
What I've seen so far is much too big for us. I mean, the cubic meter of ice, even smaller than that, is really heavy. This ice is really heavy.
The Richards are quiet and intense. Wyman has the wheel. He strains his eyes, and occasionally he reaches for binoculars. Then he sees something.
So what do you see there, Wyman?
We're going to need a small piece right there. We're going to try and take that piece on board now.
He kills the engine. Dale and Damien throw down 2 steel anchors which steady the boat. They take their places. Dale's near the cabin, poised to lift the weight of the berg with the help of a very squeaky mechanical muscle, the hydraulics. Wyman grabs the net. It's homemade and looks like a giant butterfly catcher. In his t-shirt, steel-toed boots, shades, and a goatee, Wyman actually looks more like a cowboy than a fisherman as he gets ready to wrangle a bucking berg. Wyman leans out over the boat and holds the net down.
What's the problem?
It's too big. It's too heavy, and where she's rocking, we can't get the swing ahead. Can't get the dip net to swing ahead.
Dale swings the boat around and corners the fleeing berg.
Go ahead, Anna, now.
Wyman plunges the net and rotates his left shoulder, then his right.
Oh, no.
Dale cranks the hydraulics up, and the ice rises out of the ocean. And then the berg slips out and plunges back into the water. Round two. Wyman nets one side of it, then turns the net until the whole berg is inside. The great net swings up and over the side of the boat. Weighing in at several thousand pounds, the netted bergy bit hovers above the deck.
Put it up there.
The Cape Richard pulls back into the St. Anthony Harbor at 6 o'clock. They've been out on the water for about 4 hours. It's supper time. Dale calls a takeout restaurant and orders 3 hamburger platters. Then it's 2 more hours breaking up the ice with an axe, then shoveling it into transport tubs. Marshall Dean hauls it back to the plant in his pickup truck. These bergy bits are going to melt down to 1,000 gallons of water.
How long does it usually take to melt this stuff down?
We use some heaters to kind of assist the process, but it'll take 2 to 3 days to melt it down, basically.
Right now, the young company is struggling. The chemist doubles as receptionist, and the president sometimes operates the bottling machine. But as for the fisherman moonlighting as an iceberg cowboy, it's been a fair day's roundup. And he'll be back at it again tomorrow, if the weather's good.
I really look forward to it now. I mean, after we made our first trip and saw that it was going to work. Yeah, I look forward to it, and no problem at all making a week's pay at it. No problem at all.
Jenna Graham reported that piece for us. Working is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. You can see pictures of an iceberg hunt and hear all the other stories in the series at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, you know how every time you go to see the doctor, she's always using a pen or maybe a coffee cup that's got some drug's brand name plastered all over it? Well, no more. The drug industry's main lobbying group revised its code of conduct today. No more freebies like restaurant meals or sticky pads. The Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America says it's complying with the highest standards of ethical conduct in its new policies. But those big consulting contracts and the all-expenses-paid trips to professional seminars on, say, Maui, those are still totally fine. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow rose 81 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ added 22 points, 1%. The S&P 500 gained 8 points. That's 0.7% there. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, John Haas, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, the real money in virtual gifts.
Me throwing a snowball at you, I could be flirting with you, I could be mad at you, I could be, you know, just saying hi.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.